offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind. And we are delighted to continue the Bhagavata Vahini. We had a break 3 weeks because we took up an interesting topic, which was interesting for us. We hope it was interesting for all you listeners too. We spoke about the four ashramas. But we are back to the story, and the part of the story we are in at this moment is, we all know that the scene is set for the Bhagavatam to be related. The relation of the Bhagavatam has begun, actually, where Sage Sukha has been talking about the different avatars that the Lord takes, with specific relevance and importance given to the Purna avatars, or the avatars which are more relatable. And we started speaking about the Rama avatar as related by Sage Sukha to Parikshit. A few aspects, the most important one being the vow that Rama takes, and we spoke extensively about that the last time around, where Rama says that whoever it may be, if one takes refuge in me, it becomes my duty to take care of his welfare. And the episode of Vibhishana was given as a beautiful example to that. But before we progress in the story, because this part of the story is the actual Bhagavatam, you know, every time we speak about the Bhagavatam, what is important or what is the standout is the story of Lord Krishna. So we are going to begin that this week. But before we come to that story, and before we speak a little more about the Rama avatar as explained by Swami in the Bhagavat Vahini in this chapter we are in, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Preman, as always, it's a great pleasure and privilege to be sitting here in the center of the spiritual capital of the universe and talking about Swami. Talking about, yes, Bhagavata Vahini, as we have said it time and again, is nothing but a discussion, listening and speaking about the glories of the Purna Avatar. And, you know, going to the Bhagavata Vahini, it becomes really difficult for us to keep in mind about whom it is being described. You know, when Swami is describing things about Krishna, we are reminded of our own Sai Krishna. And that is the beautiful thing, I think, the common thread between all the avatars of the Lord is that since they embody the same pure divine love and selflessness, one avatar reminds us of the other. And really, the Bhagavatam is such an easy way for a spiritual aspirant because, you know, it can be listened to at any time. It can be listened to at any place. You know, it reminds me, just yesterday, I was invited to a bhajan. It was a lovely thing, and interestingly, the bhajan was held in a parking lot of the building, you know. So, there for the bhajans, we had the gents, the ladies, the children, and the bikes, the cycles, the cars. They were all there in the parking lot, and we did the bhajan. After the bhajan, there was a dinner, and during the dinner, you know, I feel a Bhagavata Vahini satsang happened there itself. Very interesting, very nice, so lovely, and this is one theme under which, you know, anything I can narrate, because everything is the glory of Bhagwan. So even from a practical point of view, a satsang on the Bhagavata Vahini becomes so easy because there's nothing like out of topic. Everything under the Lord's gaze is within topic. So yesterday, as I said, during dinner, I happened to speak to Brother Ravi Teja, you know, and he narrated a very beautiful episode. And because this is Bhagavata Vahini, I thought let's begin with our Sai Bhagavatam. He was saying how, you know, this was in the year 1989. So those years, the sports meet was not a display kind of sports meet that we have.
Right.
In another month from now, we'll be having the annual cultural and sports meet. It was more like a competitive sports meet. So you would have marathon running, you would have 100 meter dash, you would have long jump, high jump, all this. And everybody wanted to participate because the winners will be given their prize from Swami's hands. And you know, Prem, the amazing thing is it's not just the, like in the years we were studying, we saw how Swami would give the trophy to the cultural champion and the athletic champion.
Right.
It was not only the champion. The prize winner of every event would get prizes from Swami's hand. So if you're first in running, first in long jump, and not only the first, the second and third, and apparently Swami gave away even consolation prizes. I think the whole campus must have been receiving prizes from Swami. So Ravi Teja, Brother Ravi Teja was saying that he was participating in the long jump event, and he mistimed his jump, or he didn't land well. Yeah, he didn't land properly, because of which he got a bad twist, and it when he was taken to the hospital, they found out that it was not a fracture, but something worse than that, which is a tear. What do you call it?
A ligament tear.
Fracture is bad. A ligament tear is the nightmare. Right. Having personally gone through it, because a fracture heals in something like 4 weeks. A ligament tear may take any time between 4 months to 4 years.
Right.
So he had this ligament tear and he was in pain and he hobbled back to the hostel and he was saying that the same evening, he couldn't go to the mandir for darshan because the pain was terrible. And he lay down on his bed and he started feeling sad. He said, I started feeling so sad because, you know, I'm missing darshan. But along with that, other things came that when Swami gives prizes, I won't be getting anything from his hand. Forget, I was trying to get the first prize. I won't be getting any prize because I'm disqualified. I'm not even participating, nothing. And he said, as I thought of all this, I began to feel so sad that tears started flowing down my eyes. So lying on my bed, I covered myself completely with the sheet so that nobody sees. Apparently, there was one boy who was staying back, sacrificing his mandir to be there as a helper for him. So he was lying down there and he was crying under the sheets, he said. At that time, suddenly, you know, this helper boy comes and taps him on his shoulder, telling him to wake up. I mean, patting him, obviously thinking that he's sleeping. But Brother Ravi Teja didn't want to open the bedsheet because he didn't want his attending boy to see how much he's crying. So he said, I know, but I want to sleep, kind of. But the tapping was persistent and he slightly opened the bedsheet and he says, to his, what do you call, pleasant shock, he said, I saw the flowing robe of Bhagwan, the orange robe, you know, and he didn't know. And once again, you know, Swami bent down and he's saying, one foot away from my face is this round luminous face of Bhagwan looking and asking, what happened? You know, and he's saying, I quickly took out my sheet and I wiped my tears and I said, Swami, I had this fall. Swami said, yes, I know. And he said, along with Swami was, oh God, how could I forget former editor, Shri V.K. Narasimhan sir.
Okay.
So V.K. Narasimhan sir, apparently in V.K. Narasimhan sir's car, Swami had got in. This he got to know later. Swami had got into V.K. Narasimhan sir's car and told, come, let's go for a drive. And had just turned into the hostel during darshan hours because there was nobody in the hostel. And Swami had just walked in, come straight to this room. So that attending boy also got to know and he came rushing later. But Swami had come directly and woken him up. And so Brother Ravi Teja gets up and he sees Swami standing there behind him, V.K. Narasimhan. And Swami says to V.K. Narasimhan, you know, this boy, he's the long jump champion. He got first prize in long jump. Okay. And he says that this is so sweet on Swami's part because I had not got any, I had disqualified. And Swami said, only thing, no, he didn't land properly. When you land, you have to take support with your hands, but he just left go because of which he got this pain, papam. And Brother Ravi is not able to get up and stand, so he's just sitting propped against the wall. And he said, I was dumbstruck, I didn't know what to speak only. Swami said, you don't worry, it'll all be fine. Materialized Vibhuti gave it to him. And then Swami said, now I'll just go there, I'll see other rooms also. And he says, I was simply dazed. I was just sitting there and looking at Swami, who had come all the way to give me darshan and so much of love. And he says, Swami told him, don't you want to take Padnamaskar? So he said, oh, that is when I realized, oh yes, Swami Padnamaskar. And he took his Padnamaskar and then Swami walked out and left. And he said that, you know, many have been the times where I have won prizes and I have received prizes from Swami's hands. But the year when I couldn't receive directly prize from Swami's hand has turned out to be the most memorable one for me. That is what Swami does. You know, that is, it is so sweet, wonderful. You know, while the dinner filled my stomach, my heart was overflowing listening to this beautiful episode. That's why I say this is the magic of the Sai Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam, in fact, you can listen to it anytime, any place.
Absolutely. You know, there's no difference between Bhagavatam and Sai Bhagavatam. There's a beautiful conversation between Hislop and Swami, where Hislop was asking a question. We know that most of the conversations are Hislop asking questions and Swami answering him. So at one point, Hislop was asking this question and he said, Swami, from the time of Krishnavatar to now, you know, that was how he was framing his question. And Swami just cut him short there. Swami said, what? What do you mean from the time of Krishnavatar to now? Swami said, I am Krishna, there is no time. Very, very powerfully, Swami said, I am Krishna now and there is no time. according to Swami. So there is, I mean, it is from our point of view that from the time of Krishna Avatar, and you know, now it's Swami. And of course, talking about sports, me at the risk of again disappointing Hanuman, whenever Rama's story is spoken, you know, it is said that he is supposed to be here. And I think he'll be telling that every time I come here and you guys disappoint me by not speaking about Rama.
But if he's recognizing the timelessness that you spoke
absolutely,
about,
he will not.
Then I don't think you'd have a problem.
You know, this is narrated by the former warden of the hostel, Dr. Pallav Barua.
Okay.
He was narrating when he was a student in Vrindavan, the same sports meet, the competitive sports which he used to have. So they used to come from Vrindavan and there used to be matches between Vrindavan campus and Prashanthi Nilayam campus. So their cricket team was very strong, right? So they used to
Vrindavan.
So they used to win the cricket team, but they were bad at all other sports because the Parthi boys were senior boys.
Correct,
so they used to beat them in football and all the other games. So he was part of, I think, football and volleyball. So they went and invited Swami for the match. They said, Swami, we're going to have a volleyball match today. And typical of Swami, Swami said, volleyball, Sugriva ball, I don't know anything like that and all that. Then finally Swami said, okay, I'll come. So they started the match and probably a few points into the match, they heard Swami's card and Swami came and they had made we have a photo of that. There's a Shamiana and Swami sitting there with students and teachers sitting around Swami.
Mm-hmm.
So Swami sat and Swami said, okay, start playing. So these boys start playing and they were, you know, one team was far superior to the other. So the points are all going, you know, lopsided, all one love, two love, three love. And these people were not doing anything, were not able to get any points. Pallav sir was telling that it was so embarrassing that, and boys were getting injured in between.
Mm-hmm.
In the sidelines of the match, he was saying that one of the key players had already got his knee injured. And our Shailesh sir was sitting next to him and reading Satcharitra to you know, pep him up.
Oh, okay.
Oh. You know, all this was happening there. And Swami sitting there and seeing the match. So the first set was over. They lost the first set. And the second set was played and they lost the second set. So it was a best of three and the match was over.
Hmm.
But Swami didn't seem to be wanting to get up. So they said, okay, we'll make it best of five then. So they played the third set and they lost the third set too. So even the best of five was over. And they looked at Swami and Swami is showing no signs of getting up at all. You know, he was absolutely happy sitting there, cracking some jokes. And I think that apparently that was the time when Swami made that beautiful, important teaching based on, you know, volleyball.
Where, right? Swami said that, when the volleyball is given, both the teams are going on making efforts to ensure that the ball doesn't fall down. They strive, they fall. If needed, they injure themselves, but they ensure that the ball does not fall. Like that only Swami said, I too have set the ball rolling. And now that I have...
I
have served the ball. I have served the ball. Now it is your duty as teachers or students or people of my mission to ensure that the ball that has been served is always kept flying high and it never falls down.
Right. That was the time when Swami made this remark. But Swami was like cracking jokes and saying all kinds of things, making fun of teachers sitting next to him, but he was not willing to get up. And how will you lose a chance of Swami watching a match? So he said that after that, they said, you know, forget the match, forget how many sets it is. We'll just keep playing. And they kept playing for something like 45 minutes to 1 hour. It started drizzling. Still Swami didn't want to get up. So in the rain, they kept playing. Then after about 1 hour or something, Swami said, okay, papam, let's stop it. And then Swami called all of them and he said that that was one of the best photographs they had. All the players drenched and literally hugging Swami, and Swami was drenched because of, you know, all the other boys, their you know, tracksuits being drenched.
I don't know if you missed it, Prem, but when I heard Pallav sir narrating this episode, one more detail that he mentioned was, though they began to play friendly, they continued to play it like a match. In the sense, there were points,
okay,
and it was going on. But you know, after Prashanthi Nilayam had won about five sets in a row, it now became evident that it's like a chance thing, right? So they were no longer waiting to, you know, pummel the opposition into submission. So everybody was given chance to play. Mm-hmm. So around the sixth or seventh set, I don't remember which, the exact number, but Vrindavan won it.
Right, right.
And then Swami said, all have won now, both teams won. So, so for Swami, it doesn't matter that it is 6-1 or 7-1, all are winners. And we have seen that time and again, you know, after sports meet, Swami would announce the winner's cups. And the winner's cups would go to the primary school, the higher secondary school, the Vrindavan campus, the Parthi campus, the Anandpur, everybody would be the winners. I think that is how for Bhagwan life is. That's how for Bhagwan sports is. Because everybody is a winner, nobody is a loser. Because when you're with God, how can you ever be a loser?
Absolutely. And what a beautiful lesson that whole thing is. You know, because we don't get into something if it is not going to give us something out of that. You know, we are so competitive. I have to win something. I have to achieve something. But oftentimes, some youth say, no, life is a game, play it. You know, just play it. Like I think Dana Gillespie says that once, every time she would go for an interview, Swami would ask her, what do you want? Ask something. And she said that I'll be so blank that I'm just happy to be with him. I would never ask him. So she said only once she took the courage and asked this question, Swami. She said, Swami, what is the point of all of this? Hmm. Meaning that all this life and you struggle and you're born and you go through life. She said, what is the point of all of this? And Swami just said, it's a game, just play it. That's all. And she said that it made so much sense the way Swami said it. Of course, with the frame of mind that she asked that. And finally, that's what it is. You just have to play it without worrying about who's going to win, who's getting the points. And with the knowledge that, yes, Swami is sitting there and watching, just for the thrill of the Lord who is watching.
See, to get this appreciation of that statement, you know, life is a game, just play it, because you have to play it. It takes some time, because all the time we are playing games of our level. Let me clarify what I mean by this. See, when I am playing a cricket match and I want to win it, I will not be able to appreciate what is meant by life is a game, play it. But now, you know, my 2-year-old daughter, she calls me to play some of her games. You know, her games are so, I don't know what to say, they're not even games. They feel so lame for me, you know. She just picks up and there's a make-believe doll. Even though you have a doll, you have a make-believe doll and you say this is what it is and you feed the doll. For me, it feels, as I said, very, it doesn't feel like a game at all, because it doesn't seem to have a point. It seems so pointless. But I still play it because there is so much joy in doing that, you know. Because she's enjoying it and her joy is giving me joy, I play it. Though it is pointless, I play it. And with that in mind, I'm able to appreciate what is meant by life is a game, play it. You know, there is no question of asking, why should I do it? What is the point of it all? It's not, there's no point of it all as such. The point is just to be happy and blissful.
Exactly. In fact, the exact words which Swami said was, play the game, be happy. Those are the 5 words that Swami uttered.
And that's the reason why I play with my daughter. The only reason I play with her is because it just makes me happy. Because there's no point in the game. There's no goal in the game. There's nothing like this is a winner, this is a loser. Nothing seems to be there. And I feel, that's why I said, at a lower level, when we look at, we are able to appreciate the meaning of life is a game, play it. Because when I am playing my games, it feels like, no, there's a point, and this is a... And when I say games, it's not just cricket, football. My career, my position, my job, whatever I'm doing, my stage in life as a married person, as a person who is in a relationship, or as a grandfather who is looking after his grandchildren, whatever. All of that seems like very serious business. We tell our children, hey, come on, this is not a game, okay, this is life. But the child might be smiling, and in the childlike innocence, God will be telling, that is precisely what it is. It's a game. There's no point. The objective is not to amass wealth. The objective is not to amass power. The objective is nothing but to just be happy. There's no point of it all. Really very, very profound message.
Absolutely. And there is no, I mean, this joy of really living life for Swami will only come when there is that acknowledgement of Swami's presence. And that's the whole idea of Bhagavatam. I think the last time around when we were speaking also, that's what we said. One of the key things that an avatar achieves by coming down on earth is giving us that idea that, yes, Swami is here. I was telling somebody the other day, you know, now Swami is physically not here. You know, how is it here? And I think it was around 7:38 in the evening. And I was telling that person, see, right now we are in the ashram walking around. And when Swami was in Prashantinilam, in the physical body, Swami was, of course, confined to some room where I can't see him, right? But still I had the idea that Swami is there. And my behavior would be according to that, that Swami is there. That is what happens when an avatar comes, that God is there. That feeling actually regulates your whole life. And I think that option is there any time of, time, you know, whichever time and space you belong to. Even now, if I believe that Swami is there, then I will behave accordingly. And that is the greatest thing about the Bhagavatam, because it talks about those devotees, their lives, how they changed when they acknowledged this fact that God is there. You know, God has come in the form of Rama, Krishna, or whatever it is. like the story of Prahlada, Swami would often say that he believed that God is there. And everything that he said and did was in accordance to that. And God had to prove him right because he was so convinced about the fact that God is there everywhere, wherever it is, even if it's a pillar.
Absolutely. Coming back to where we had left off the last time we were discussing the Bhagavata Vahini, we were, as you said, we were in the Ramavatar. We still have a little more discussion to conclude the Ramavatar as per the Bhagavata Vahini. But you know, one thing that strikes about the difference between the Ramavatar and the Krishnavatar is that, you know, it's often said, follow the actions of Rama, follow the words of Krishna. It is because you are simply unable to comprehend and understand the actions of Krishna. They are all leelas. And I feel it is with a reason. Because, you know, the Ramavatar comes with that speciality that you can directly follow whatever he has done. And you also see that goodness being rewarded and evil being punished. All of it happens completely. There are no questions left at the end of the Ramayana. Once you finish the Ramayana, anybody who has truly and attentively listened to and imbibed it will be convinced that be good because goodness begets goodness and evil begets evil. Which is not the case with Krishna stories. You know, when we listen to the Bhagavatam and the Mahabharatam and all that which follows, the entire life of Krishna, at the end of it, one might have a million questions, you know. A million questions, whether it is like, you know, how do you explain the death of Abhimanyu? How do you explain the death of Ghatotkacha, the Upapandavas? Even the so-called evil, Karna's death. You know, there are so many so many dramas made, so many novels written on the glory of Karna, where Karna is the protagonist. How can a person who is a villain in the epic be a protagonist in the... But that is how confusing the Mahabharata and the things that Krishna achieved in his lifetime can get. That is why it is said, do not follow the actions of Krishna. Because they are far too complicated for you to understand. But that is where the speciality of the Ramavatar comes, where it is said, directly follow the actions of Rama. That is the reason why the Ramavatar itself happened. Rama is considered as the perfect man. It is the first instance of Daivam Manusha Rupena. And that is the speciality of the Ramavatar that we have to appreciate, because Rama is considered as the concretization of Dharma itself.
No, I was once talking to one of our senior staff in the administrative block, Vijay Sarthi sir. Mm-hmm. And recently, he's actually released a book on the Ramayana. He's written the whole Ramayana in poetic form in Telugu.
Okay.
And the beauty of that is it's about the tattvam behind the Ramayana. So once he was telling us, you know, I mean, he'll give explanations for what is the tattva of Lakshmana, what is the tattva of Sita and all of that. Similar to what Swami has written in the Adhyatma Ramayana. And of course, this is a little more detail in that. So he was making this point, and I hope I'm quoting him right. He said this very, very profound point. He said, if you look at Rama is a dharma avatar. A dharma avatar can be followed, because he will express dharma in every action of his. He said, if you look at Krishna is actually a jnana avatar. It is an expression of wisdom, and it is even very difficult to follow that. You know, wisdom, unless you are in that level, you're operating from that level, you cannot understand all his actions.
Exactly.
And of course, as an extension, he went on to say, Swami is actually a prema avatar, and it's even more difficult when anything is done out of love, unless you are in that same selfless level. You cannot understand his actions, and even then, I don't think you can ever understand Swami's actions. But I thought that was really profound, and that is how you need to look at these avatars, where you look at Rama and say that he is a dharma avatar. You can look at him and obey every action of his, of course, pertaining to that role that he played, as Swami would often call our attention to.
And you know, this aspect that Rama is a dharma avatar and you follow him at any cost, it is beautifully highlighted within the Ramayana itself. I think no other epic has episodes like this, wherein you see in Ramayana, the brother Bharata, he gives up everything for the sake of the brother. You know, there is nothing like, if you make a rule that mother is God, follow the mother. It's not like that. Because Bharata disowns his mother for the sake of a brother. Same thing happens with Lakshmana. He disowns his wife for the sake of a brother. And it's not just in the case of brothers. you see a possibly in the modern day context, I don't know how do you say, but in those times it was a friend. Jatayu is actually a friend. For the sake of a friend's child, he gives up his life. Why? Because that friend's child happens to be Rama. The same thing you'll see, Vibhishana gives up his brother for the sake of Rama. You see everybody giving up different relationships. All relation, you know, if you were to rank the relationships and you say that the mother is number one, the father is number two and so on, all those rules are broken because in the Ramayana it becomes clear that number one is Rama, the Lord, whatever be your relationship with him. If the Lord happens to be your friend's son, then your friend's son is the most important. If the Lord happens to be your enemy, then the enemy is the most important. If the Lord happens to be your husband, then your husband is most important. So, what is most important gets defined by who the Lord is. So, even within the epic, it becomes very clear that Rama is the person to follow. And that is the beauty of Ramayana. It not only teaches us that you have to follow Rama in everything, it also gives instances within the epic itself of different people who are either very close to Rama or even very far from Rama, who have the same feeling for Rama and consider Rama as prime in their life. So the thing about you following Rama is highlighted within the Ramayana itself.
In fact, you know, there's a discourse where Swami speaks about this. Swami would say that what is dharma, and when you look at it, it's like the son should obey the father, the wife should always be by the side of the husband, and Swami gives all of those things, but Swami tells that all of these equations go awry when God comes into the picture. And Swami gives the example of Prahlada who defies his father, Gopikas who defy their husband, Meera who defies her husband, and Swami gives all of those examples like Bharata and Vibhishana. Swami says that once God comes into the picture, that is when every other dharma actually takes a back step. And that's precisely what Krishna tells Arjuna, right? Sarva dharman parityajya. He said you might have all these roles to play, but once God comes into the picture, he gets priority, and that becomes the highest dharma. And that is precisely what is, you know, spoken of in the case of Rama and of course all the other avatars too.
You know, very interestingly, during one Trai session in Vrindavan, one student actually asked this to Swami, and the translator means, you know, amplified it and told Swami. The question was, Swami, I want to stay here for vacation. I want to be with Swami. But my parents keep telling you have to come back home, like come back home. What should I do, Swami? Should I do what I feel like or should I listen to my parents? You know, he's asking this question to the Guru, to the Lord, to the being who says Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava. So Swami said, you should lovingly try to explain to your parents the wisdom behind why you are staying back. And you know, Swami said, you be polite, be sweet, but you have to be firm. You have to tell them that. And Swami didn't stop at that. Swami went on to say, you have to show them in your character, in your nature. They should themselves see and tell, you know, how different my child is because he goes there. Unlike other children, he doesn't run to the movies. He doesn't run behind girls. He doesn't do all this. Instead, how disciplined he is, how reverent he is, how loving he is. Your parents should observe all this. And they themselves will feel, no, you be with Swami only. You know, Swami said all this. But after that, though he didn't tell directly, you know, Swami said, you should always remember that when it comes to God, all other relationships can be given up. Swami said, Bharata gave up the mother for the sake of Rama. Lakshmana gave up wife for the sake of Rama. Vibhishana gave up his brother for the sake of Rama. Prahlada gave up his father for the sake of Narayana. You know, and Swami quoted many such examples. So, though directly Swami didn't tell him that if after all this also your parents don't allow you, just disobey them. But that was very clear that you'd be good, you try to do your best in the most pleasing way possible, but if none of that works, don't forget that God is the only top priority, God is the only relationship, all other relationships becomes subservient or secondary.
But in the absence of, you know, the ability to choose like this, I always think it's very easier when Swami is physically there. Like in the case of Arjuna, the choice between God and the world was so easy because God was really there, lying there on that bed, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when it is not there, how do you choose? And I think that example is given in Rama's life where Swami makes that beautiful comparison between how he reacts versus how his father reacted. And Swami says, Dasharatha, when he was pushed to the corner, he chose to obey his wife and send his son away. And Swami does not speak of it as, you know, Rama being, you know, something unfair being done to Rama. But as a king, he knew that this was the right thing to do, to make Rama the king. We know the Ramkatha, so anyway, gone through that, where Swami says how all the citizens were eagerly waiting for that moment when Rama would become the king. Knowing that that was the best thing for the kingdom, he chose not to do it because Swami says that he could not disobey his wife, or he could not displease his wife. But Swami says, on the other hand, Rama was such that when a commoner comes and says a word which is, you know, which is suggestive of his wife having a bad character, even though he knows that it is not true, he chooses to obey because he says, as a king, I cannot set an example such as this for the people. So I think the underlying thing is the idea of selflessness. For us, when we do not have that idea of choosing between God and the world or God and other relationships, I think what is most selfless to do from the point of view of our duty, where being where we are, there are some things which only we can do. Like a king can do some things which none of the other commoners can do. So that makes that duty actually most important for him. And Swami is saying that when Rama acted from that platform, even though for all of us as commoners, the idea is, oh, how can a husband send away a pure wife, is what we look at it. Swami says when he acted from the authority of a king, what he did was the most dharmic, because it comes from selflessness.
You know, this concept of selflessness is so deep, but one of the facets of selflessness is the broad perspective that you have. You know, Swami often says, Vyashti, Samashti, Srishti, Parameshti. He says the individual is part of society, society is part of nature, nature is part of God. So, if you are serving God, you can't say, I am serving God but I don't want to serve society. You can't say, I am serving God but I don't want to serve my family. You can't say, I love God but I don't care about the fellow man. That's how Swami says. And he extends that analogy by saying, just like how a finger is a part of the palm, which is a part of the hand, which is a part of the body, you can't serve the body without serving the other thing. You know, one finger can't say that I care for the body, I love my body, but I don't care for the ring finger. Let the ring finger get destroyed. You can't do that. That is one perspective. The other perspective is a broader perspective. You know, many times if I get a gangrene in my finger, I get my finger amputated. It doesn't mean I don't love my finger. You can say, how can you be so cruel? How can you chop off your own finger? It's part of you. Yes, I know it's part of me. But for the sake of the body, I give up my finger. So when you speak of selflessness, it's that ability to identify with the whole. You and me feel that, Rama, you sent away your wife. How could you send away your wife, who is your Ardhangi, who is your other half? But when Rama is identifying with his kingdom, every member was like a part of his family. And we have, you know, when we were discussing Ramkatha Rasamayani, we saw that also, that when Rama is being sent to the forest, the way everybody wails is as if their own father or their own son or their own child or their own brother is going to the forest. Everybody felt Rama was their own. It was natural that Rama reciprocates that everybody is my own, because as you said, he is at the level of the king. So from that point of view, when you see, it is almost like this. How can I say this finger is special? This, all the fingers are the same. In the same way, all subjects are equal to me. And that is why it becomes difficult for us to, you know, comprehend and judge Rama. That is why it is said, don't judge Rama, but you follow his actions, you will definitely be on the path of Dharma.
And I think this is pretty much the part where, this is how much Swami writes in the Bhagavatam about the Ramayana, because I think, did the Bhagavatam come after the Ramakatha Swami, right?
Correct.
Chronologically.
Yes.
So Swami must have felt that, you know, it's the longest running series in the Sanatan Sarthi, the Ramkatha Swami. So in this, it's about just one chapter where Swami speaks about
where he is just summarizing. It's almost what is left unsaid is, in case you wish to get greater details, please refer to my previous book.
And at this point, actually, Parikshit is very, very pleased. He is expressing his gratitude to Sage Sukha, but also expresses the idea that I'm so thrilled listening to about Rama and Rama's glory, but I'm still waiting for the stories of Krishna to start, because that is what I want to fill my consciousness with even as I leave this body. And that is the prayer he places before Sukha.
But before we get into the enchanting stories of Krishna, dear listeners, it's time for us to take a quick break. Don't go away anywhere, because on the other side of the break, we will continue with the stories of the Chitta Chora. Welcome back, dear listeners. We are, as promised, moving on to the stories of Krishna, the Krishna avatar, the stories which Parikshit is very eager to listen. And I'm sure you and all of us are eager to listen because it is so similar to the stories of our Swami. But Prem and me would be failing in our responsibility if we directly dive into Krishna's story, because there's one very, very important point that Swami makes about the Ramavatar, and we definitely need to spend some thought on that. And that is this. Swami says that Rama is the ideal for everyone, especially for all householders, which I'm sure constitutes the majority of the people in the world. As we had discussed during the satsang on the four ashramas, the world is left with very few brahmacharis of the true nature, very few vanaprasthis and very few sannyasis. Most of us are grihasthas irrespective of what stage of life we are in, because we are constantly clamoring behind the same goals that a grihastha is supposed to go for. So, Swami says for every grihastha, Rama is the ideal. And why? Why? What is that softer aspect of his nature and attitude that we should learn when we say that Rama is the model to follow? And that, Swami says, is the equanimity that Rama displayed. When you look at Rama's face, Swami says that you will not be able to make out whether he has been told that he is to be crowned as the emperor of Ayodhya and the whole sovereign, he is supposed to be the sovereign of the entire nation, or whether he has been told that you have to give up everything and go live as a recluse in a forest. From Rama's face, you can't make out what is the news that has been conveyed to him, and that speaks of the mighty equanimity that he possessed, and that is an ideal for every householder in the world today.
No, absolutely. And this is like Swami has said in many, many ways. You know, Swami would quote the words from the Gita, Samatvam Yoga Muchyate. Swami would say, true yoga is only that equanimity. And Swami would also say, bhakti is also that equanimity. And Swami would say, I think the letter which he wrote to his brother, he said, to accept good and bad and pain and pleasure as one is devotion for me. Swami said, that is my definition of devotion. Mm. So in whichever way you look at it, you look at yourself as a yogi who's trying to progress, or you look at yourself as a devotee who's trying to purify one's love, the state which Swami expects one to reach is that equanimity. And that's why so beautifully Swami has said that you may not be able to relate to some of the decisions that he has made and not able to understand, and may not be even in a position to emulate some of them. But this equanimity is something that you can always strive for, because in the process of that, you will be doing the right things.
In fact, you know, the Ramayana that was made, I think Raman Sagar made the Ramayana.
Right.
Or
right.
Okay, even in the Ramayana that has been made, it is very, very beautifully shown. Very rarely do you see Rama getting angry. When we read the Ramkatha Rasavahini, we realize that there was not an instant when Rama got angry. But though it is man-made, they have come pretty close to that. You know, whether he is battling Ravana or whether he is marrying Sita, the same kind of serenity, peace exudes from Rama's face. You know, that is why I keep often telling everyone that whenever I think of Rama as a person, the actor who has acted in that Ramanand Sagar's Ramayana, that is the face that comes, because he has done such a role so wonderfully. And I believe that nobody could have done a role so well unless the spirit of Rama himself in some way descended into that being, you know. Anyway, that shows, they say the face is the index of the mind. That kind of serenity that is exuded by Rama, irrespective of what is happening. When Shurpanaka is coming to attack Sita, when Sita is kidnapped, when you're getting married to Sita, as a child also, every time Rama was absolutely placid. Of course, later modern depictions in cartoons, we see Rama, you know, lamenting. But that also Swami so beautifully clarifies in the Ramkatha Rasavahini about Rama's lamenting when Sita is left. Because just before that, Rama and Sita, as we have seen in the Ramkatha Rasavahini, they have this private discussion in the absence of Lakshmana in the hut, where Rama tells Sita that, Sita, now the time has come, now the drama has to begin, so let's begin. So even those few instances when Rama is emotional, Rama is apparently tearful, or he's sad, he's upset, that is just a drama. It becomes amply clear when we read the Ramkatha Rasavahini. No other place do we see Rama getting emotional at all. And that is because of this kind of equanimity. And Swami himself has defined what is this equanimity. He says, irrespective of what happens to you in life, good or bad, you should be able to close your eyes and say, this is good for me. This is the best for me. That is why God has chosen this for me. And when you say that, you will always have only gratitude, because irrespective of what happens, you are closing your eyes and thanking God for the prasadam that He has given. In fact, that is what Swami would say about prasad also in the temple. Swami would say that you don't go and when you receive prasad, you won't taste it until, you know, sugar is little less in this, salt is little more in this, it's not good. Whatever is given, even when a neem leaf is given, if it's bitter, you reverently apply it to your forehead or your eyes and you eat it. And when you eat it, you don't even make a, you know, face of disgust or any kind of thing. With a kind of calm equipoise, you partake it. Swami says, that is how you should lead your entire life. Accept everything as God's prasad. And that is the definition of equanimity.
Absolutely. And the best, it's best portrayed in Rama's life because of the twists and turns it, you know, the life takes. But so is the life of Krishna. Because, you know, when we talk of Krishna, we don't, as you're saying, you don't picture a phase of equanimity. You only picture a phase of mischief, right? And that was, I think, the next level when you're talking about handling your problems. Because he was somebody who could really laugh away all his problems, not literally be equanimous and pass through them. And there's an interesting forward, I don't know if it's a real conversation, it's recorded in the Bhagavatam or anything, where, you know, it's a conversation between Karna and Krishna. Where Karna is saying that, you know, what a cursed fate I have. I'm actually supposed to be a ruler of the Kuru dynasty and I'm born as a, you know,
as the eldest among the Pandavas.
Right, I'm born as a son of a charioteer and all of that. You know, every time I was insulted and all that. And then Krishna looks at him and smiles and says, all that is fine. Did you ever examine my life? And he says, even I was a prince, but I was born in a prison. And I was brought up incognito away from my parents. You know what, in the name of protecting me. And, you know, he actually starts talking of all his life, like how we talk of our life.
You know, that's what, all, you know, the problems. I appreciate this because, though it is not the exact sequence, but multiple depictions of the Mahabharata show Karna complaining to Krishna.
Right.
Telling that, Krishna, I am not bad. That is one of the reasons why, as I said, though Karna is on the enemy camp, there are stories of him being the protagonist. Because everyone says that, you know, Karna was having a bad fate. Karna did wrong, yes. But look at how bad his fate was. He was born to be a ruler, but he was made into a charioteer's son. Though he was a charioteer's son, he didn't give up. He fought and he was the most accomplished archer. Yet he was put down. And it was only Duryodhana who took care of him. That's why he was, serving Duryodhana. So many things are told as justification to Karna. But people forget that Krishna had a worse childhood and worse upbringing. You know, even as a baby, murderers were sent out for him. Multiple people came to squelch the life out of his body, you know, multiple times. And after that, Krishna was also born to be a ruler. But he never ruled. He never ruled. He was always the kingmaker. Whoever was associated with Krishna became rulers. Krishna never became. You know how discouraging that might be. Whoever associates with you becomes a superhero, becomes a ruler, and you are a nobody. And finally, if Krishna has to complain, I ended up being a charioteer in the end. Washing Arjuna's horses, cleaning them every night, keeping them fit for next day morning. What is this? But nobody considers Krishna as unlucky because everyone wants to be in Krishna's position. And you realize that is because of the way Krishna was. As you rightly said, Krishna's equanimity is not projected as such. Krishna is such a multi-layered, multifaceted, you know, like a, what do you say, no comparison at all. So many peels, so many layers around. As we peel each layer, we can spend hours and days and lifetimes admiring each layer. But definitely we have to agree that it's not just that Rama was equanimous, though it is seen very clearly, Krishna too is an epitome of equanimity.
Every time we speak about Krishna, I always make a reference to what K. M. Munshi has written in his Krishna Avatar. You know, his character sketch of Krishna is so very beautiful. I mean, someone who has really looked at the avatar of Krishna and tried to internalize what he stood for.
Mm.
And he writes of Krishna as somebody who's so obsessed with this idea of establishing dharma. And, you know, that's how he portrays all his actions. Here is a person from his young age, he's all the time thinking, what can I do to establish dharma in this land? And, you know, when in this conversation which I was referring to between Krishna and Arjuna, that's what Krishna tells in the end. See, this is what you have to do. You have to give yourself for the establishment of dharma and happily do whatever you have to do for that sake. Not complaining about what I am doing now, where I am now, when, you know, I am so unfortunate, I have had these, reverses in life. He says, no, that's not how you go about it. Whatever it is, it calls for to establish dharma, you keep doing that and you do it willfully and joyfully. And that's really the thing which is missing out in Karna's life, if you look at it that way.
In fact, in one of the versions of the Mahabharata, Krishna asks this question of Karna. He says, Karna, you say that you are unfortunate. You say that though you are a great archer, you were made to become a charioteer's son, and after that, even after you proved yourself, you are still not getting the recognition you deserve. Krishna then asks Karna, tell me, Karna, now that you have achieved, you have become the Angaraja, you are a ruler of a kingdom, tell me how many such deserving people who have not got recognition you have recognized? This is a question Krishna asks Karna. How many are there who are good at archery but have not got recognized, possibly because of circumstances in their life? Have you done anything for their uplift? You were specially selected by destiny and fate. You were the selected one among such beings to get uplifted and to become the king of Anga. But still, you have not done anything to those kind of that community. That community which is highly talented, has got all the abilities, but is not getting recognition. What have you done for them? You know, as you rightly said, Krishna was always about striving to do action for the betterment of the world, for the establishment of dharma in the world. Not one moment stopping to pause and one ponder about, what about me then? What happened to me? What? I mean, Krishna was a charioteer finally, if you see. But Krishna is the Lord because of what he has done. Today he is worshipped over and above all the other characters of his lifetime. And that is a powerful message that we definitely have to learn from the Krishna avatar.
And, you know, talking about Krishna avatar, I recall Swami making the statement during one of the Krishna Ashtami discourses.
Mm-hmm.
This is one avatar speaking about the other, and Swami said, there is no avatar speaking about whom you can get as much joy as when you get when you're speaking about the childhood of Krishna. And I think it was the 2004 or 5 Krishnashtami discourse. It was all about Krishna's sweetness in his childhood. And Swami would say that just the mere observance of Krishna and his leelas could give the highest bliss. And in fact, I think many times Swami would say this. That is why almost all those gopikas and gopalas around Krishna were actually great saints who probably had not tasted that highest bliss in spite of all the sadhana they've done. And they knew that when this avatar comes to be around him, you will get that bliss which you get after years and years of doing penance. And that's why they became simple gopis and gopalas around him.
Very interesting what you said, because I think the converse also holds true. You said that Krishna is such sweetness that when you listen to that story of Krishna itself, all the sweetness come to you. I think the converse is also true. Whenever you get that kind of innocent joy and delight, you remember Krishna. You know, why I'm saying this is, in many homes, when I have seen the child, it need not be a boy child, even the girl child. At my own home, I have a daughter. Whenever she does something very sweet and something that thrills the heart, people make comparisons to, she's like Krishna, you know, like Krishna. So when you say that, on one hand, thoughts of Krishna give joy, the converse also holds true. Wherever you see mischief, wherever you see joy, wherever you see innocence, you remember Krishna. You know, so that is the reason why many, many children in India, their pet names is Krishna. They actually have some other name. It might be some Raghavendra Reddy, some long one, but he'll be called Krishna at home. Krishna, Krishna, Kitta, Kittu, means all these different versions of Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, that is the sweetness of Krishna, because just like Krishna always give rise to sweetness and joy, whenever there is joy and sweetness, there is Krishna present. Even among the festivals, Krishnashtami is celebrated. And all this is the little Krishna. You know, though it might be slightly divergent, it is not out of place to remember one such being, you know, who has contributed so tremendously to Swami's mission, who would have this very practice. You know, she would call every little boy as Krishna. And I'm making reference to that great soul, that great being, that great mother who has mothered almost 35 to 40 batches of students. Warden auntie whom everyone would lovingly call as warden auntie, whom, you know, very recently, a few days before, merged in the lotus feet of beloved Bhagwan. I don't think it will be out of place to spend a few minutes thanking that soul, remembering that soul, being grateful to Swami for having sent this beautiful soul to nurture and care for all the children of the primary school. And she was one who would make reference to almost any boy who would be passing by in the hostel as Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. You know?
And of course, the reason was not there because she did not remember names. Because the students would say that she would remember their names, and if they're visiting with their family, she would remember their wife's name, their daughter's name, and that, and for batches and batches of students. As you know, as many of these devotees would say, even some of the teachers in our other campuses would say, they would remember so many students' names. And when asked, they said, this is what we've learned from Swami. Because Swami would say this, when you have interest in something, you will remember. You don't have to labor to remember, or you don't have to struggle to remember. When you have interest in what you do, you will remember. And that's what it is. You know, when you look at people like her, the way she has served. In fact, we are talking about she addressing people as Krishna. At the age of 70, at the age of 60, she had a very bad knee. She used to give birth to at least, I think, close to 50, 60 children every day. You know, the teachers used to have their own duties, and they used to share those responsibilities. It's a back-breaking job to give birth to so many children. And when asked, she would say this, I look at this as my Abhishekam to Swami. Wow. Now, that's what she used to say. And she did it without complaining for so many years. And you know, when you're talking about equanimity and all of that, she, as I said, she was having a bad knee for decades and decades. Not once she went up to Swami and she said, Swami, I'm having this pain. Give me relief. Give me vibhuti. She would say, no, whatever Swami gives is perfect. Whatever Swami gives, you have to accept it. And in fact, her daughter was talking to us, Karuna Didi, and she was telling that she was admitted in the hospital with the stomach cancer, and she was literally twisting and turning in the bed with pain. And the daughter could not bear to see the mother suffering like that. She turned to Swami's picture and said, Swami, enough is enough. How much are you going to trouble her anymore? And in that pain, Warden Auntie turns to her and says, how dare you tell this to Swami? Swami knows what is best for me. Who are you to tell enough is enough? And, you know,
she was 92, right?
I think, yeah, close to 90. I mean, that's what these people have really... I mean, it's one thing to look at Swami and learn by example, but always that idea is there, but, you know, Swami is God. Swami is Swami. How can I learn from him? And Swami knows our weakness. I think that's why Swami has left souls like this around, so that we can look at them and we have no complaints. We have to emulate these people.
You know, speaking of Warden Auntie Prem, we just spoke about how she would remember the names of every child, and not only them, their parents, and it's very amazing how an alumnus of the primary school comes back and admits his or her child in the primary school, telling, you know, they trust her to take care of the child better than what they would take care. You know, being a parent of one child itself, you know, I can understand how much responsibility, difficulty and all that it is. How it must have been for hundreds of children year after year for 35 batches. Oh my God, you know, at least if I am taking care of my own child, my child grows up. After 15 years, it's different. But here, 35 batches of... And her selflessness becomes evident from one fact, you know. You called her warden auntie. I remember once in Vrindavan, Swami just decided to... He was sitting on the stage there and he saw so many teachers of the primary school and different people working in different institutions of his. And Swami just decided that I am going to bless especially people who have contributed a lot, you know, in terms of their time, their energy, their heart, their love, their feelings. So Swami live on stage was telling the translator, you know, the warden, whom all to call. And the warden was... The warden, you know, he knew everybody there. So, as and when Swami is referring to somebody, he calls their name, gives a brief biodata of theirs. They come up the stage, receive blessings from Swami, receive a token of his love and appreciation and go down. Then Swami pointed to warden auntie. You won't believe it, Prem. on stage, the translator was tongue-tied. He didn't know her name. He said, he covered the mic and he's trying to, warden auntie. He doesn't know what to announce. He's not comfortable announcing warden auntie. He didn't know what is the name. Finally, he had to just tell warden auntie so that she gets to know that she's being referred to and she's coming on stage. It took almost 2-3 minutes. She slowly walked up the stage and received Swami's blessing. And as she was walking down, that is when it was announced, Mrs. Prema Bahal.
Prem Bahal.
Yeah, Mrs. Prem Bahal. And I'm sure more than 80 to 90% of the people who interacted with her didn't know her name at all. Because she has been, she is, and she will continue to be warden auntie forever and ever. And definitely, we are very, very grateful to Swami for having sent such beings who have been epitomes of love, selflessness, discipline, equanimity, so that we don't just look at our scriptures, the Mahabharata, the Bhagavatam, and say that, you know, it's possible in these, in the real day life, it's not possible to live like that. In order to slap us on our face and say that, look, it is possible even in this day and age, I think such beings are sent to live in our midst.
Absolutely. I think if people are interested, they should go and read that article where people have shared beautiful stories. You know, one thing which people...
It's on the Radio Sai website, right?
You know, people would say that, oh, people who come up from your schools are very, very tender and they're not prepared for the world outside. I mean, she's an example of a person, how she prepared the children. There was one student who shared that if you go to her with a bruised knee, she will not tell you, oh, beta, you've got a bruised knee. She will say, try hopping on one leg. It's fun. You will enjoy it. And, you know, she used to teach children to really face problems and pain in life with that, you know, attitude of not just equanimity, as we were saying. You know, you really take it with a smile and
practicality.
You make it fun out of it. You know, make fun out of it, really, in that sense.
You know, this is one more thing that, you know, I was not lucky to be a student under her, but I've had a few interactions with her, spoken to her once or twice, and I definitely have been around many people who have had direct interactions with her, one of whom is our own colleague, C.G. Sai Prakash. You know, when we both went to the funeral, oh my God, Prem, that was a sight to see, you know. There were like 500, 600 people who had all gathered there at the general hospital. The compound walls were almost bursting at their seams. They couldn't hold the number of people who had come. There were some 40 vehicles, many vehicles that couldn't get in. You know, there was like a convoy in the funeral. But at that moment, you know, the previous Sunday when we were all there in the general hospital, Sai Prakash comes to me and he was standing beside me and he was smiling. I said, what is that? I mean, you know, funeral, smiling. So I said, what is that you're smiling about? He said, no, this auntie, no, she, even in her going, she's very practical. I said, what do you mean? He said, if you ask auntie why she chose to go today, you know, usually we want to select a Vaikuntha Ekadashi or a holy day, that kind. He said that if you ask auntie, she will tell, see, it is better that I go on a Saturday so that when funeral is on Sunday morning, no, nobody will have to give up office work, take leave and all. They'll be able to come easily. He said, I think this is how auntie would have thought, because this is how she has been all her life, the most practical woman that I have ever seen. You know, this is just one example, but one thing that becomes evident when we read that article, it's on the Radio Sai website, as well as speak to different people who have interacted with her, is it's not as if auntie was a theoretical being propounding theoretical spirituality. She was a living goddess of spirituality and practice who showed that spirituality is not just a fad or a fashion that you wear like a modern clothing. It is something that becomes part of you. She came to the primary school with just one suitcase. Even to this day, what that remains back in primary school after she is gone is just that one suitcase. You know, just this one fact made me feel how foolish of me to try to amass and accumulate things in the world, because I won't be able to take away even what I have come with, you know. Such is the kind of practical spirituality that she lived.
And I think we should mention the way she concluded the whole journey, because when she was diagnosed with cancer and they told her, I mean, as you were saying, she's such a practical person. When the doctors told her, you know, this is what you have a stomach cancer, all that she asked was, so how much time do I have? Because that's all it mattered, you know, you're talking about Parikshit. Literally, that's the only thing she asked, and she started preparing herself in that manner. she completely withdrew from everything. She reduced all her talk and meeting with other people. And apparently sometime, I think 1 month or 2 months back, she had a, I think less than a month back, she had a dream in which she saw her own funeral. And she said, okay, now the time is really here. And she said, don't give me any more food orally. Don't come and talk to me. She literally went into a meditative state. And then they say that just the day or 2 days before she actually passed away, she was absolutely immobile. She was not eating food, right? She was, her hands had started swelling and she could not even turn by herself. Suddenly, sometime in the midnight, she raised both her hands in namaskar. She looked at Swami's picture with eyes wide open and a big smile on her face. And she was doing that namaskar for the entire night, from midnight to early in the morning. I mean, clearly, Swami must have come and given her darshan. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. There's no doubt that Swami will come, and there's no doubt that she earned that merit also.
That, you know, I don't know what else to say. It is really so beautiful, so wonderful. They say that the way a person leaves is an indicator of the way a person has led his life. And even to people like me who have not been able to see her day-to-day life, just seeing the way in which she left really gives me an idea of the kind of life she must have led. And we are truly grateful to Swami for this wonderful being. Dear listeners, this is also the Sai Bhagavatam, because as Swami says, Bhagavatam is not just the story of Bhagwan. It is also the story of the Bhakta and the story of Bhakti, devotion. The devotee, the devotion and God, all three together constitute the Bhagavatam. So while we spend time on the glories of Bhagwan, today, thanks to Auntie, we have also been blessed with a few moments to contemplate on the Bhakta and the Bhakti. We would like to recommend to all of you to please visit the Radio Sai website, the homepage, and read the article in which many, many beautiful instances of this beautiful being are there. We pray to Swami for the soul. Of course, the soul has no need of it because we know that she is at Bhagwan's lotus feet, but we pray with all our love and humility. And dear listeners, we will take another quick little break here. On the other side of the break, we will resume with the Leelas of Krishna.
Sundaruni Mohana Murani Shamasundaruni Murali Murali Shamasundaruni Murali Salagalilo Yamuna Tatipai Shamasundaruni Murali Murali Shamasundaruni Murali Ullamu Kollagane madugeetulu Ullavu kollagane madugeetulu Mella mella cheviso kunave Mella mella cheviso kunave Sallagalilo పట్టపత్రం మూలపై తేలి తేలి పడు అడుగులవే తూణిరాలు పట్టపత్రం మూలపై తేలి తేలి పడు అడుగులవే పూల దీవ పొదరిల్లు మాటుగా పూల దీవ పొదరిల్లు మాటుగా చూచు సికి పించమదే కొంచి చూచు సికి పించమదే చల్లగాలిలో తరువు తరువు కడ దాగి దాగి నందరయు చన్ను గవ మురుపులవే తరువు తరువు కడ దాగి దాగి నందరయు చన్ను గవ మురుపులవే మురిసి మురిసి నా వెనుక కరిసి కనుమూయు చివురు చెంగేలులివే మూయు చివురు చెంగేలులివే చల్లగాలిలో యమునా తటిపై శ్యామసుందరుని మురళి మురళి శ్యామసుందరుని మురళి చల్లగాలిలో యమునా తటిపై శ్యామసుందరుని మురళి మురళి శ్యామసుందరుని మురళి చల్లగాలిలో
వెల్కమ్ బ్యాక్ డియర్ లిసనర్స్ We were in that part where Swami begins talking about Lord Krishna, but you know, Swami starts talking about him in a very beautiful way because the transition is so obvious. You just spoken about Lord Rama, and Rama is referred to as Maryada Purushottam, you know, the person whom you can look up to in every phase and every aspect of life. From that epitome of, you know, how do you say, morality and dignity, you come to the avatar, which is just the next avatar, and it is like the rebel born in a human form, because he is here to break every rule and he is here to break every convention, and that is what epitomizes Krishna's childhood.
And Swami beautifully describes it also. He says, Krishna, you know, what he did, it resembled lawlessness and sheer mischief. He did not seem to care for... Swami does not even use the word he did not seem to. Swami says he did not care for human limitations and disciplines. He did not recognize the distinction between new and old. He did not respect kinship. He didn't yield to the demands of convention. I mean, he broke everything possible. When they say that nothing is impossible for God, we say it, but still we think, but God is like this, God is like that, God is like this. It is as if Krishna came to break all that. You think you say that nothing is impossible for God, but you feel, no, God can't be like this, yeah. God can't do this, yeah. I will come and do that. To show that really nothing is impossible for God, that was the embodiment of mischief and lawlessness, how, as Swami describes it, that Krishna was.
And absolutely. In fact, I was once listening to a speaker, what you call a mythologist. They study mythologies of different cultures.
Okay, huh.
And he says the completeness to the, you know, the vision of God or the approach to God, which this one avatar gives to Sanatan Dharma, is missing in most cultures. Because you always talk of God as that superior being who's always right, who's always dignified. Yes, that is God. But this aspect of God is also there, you know, and this one avatar, Krishna coming and doing all of this, and we as a culture, we rejoice it, we enjoy it, we have festivals to celebrate it. That completes the idea of God. And I mean, that's a very, very important point. As you were saying, the ability to accept everything in life comes when you know that God can do everything, right? It does not come otherwise. Otherwise, we'll think that, oh, these are things that God's grace does. These are things actually probably the Satan's or the evil aspects of life. But when you go through the life of Krishna, you see that everything is God's play. That idea of everything is a leela of God, that is so easily understandable and acceptable when you go through the Krishna avatar.
Correct. As you rightly said, these aspects will often get associated with non-godly things. You know, in quotes, telling lies. There are women walking with pots. You go behind and break the pots and run away. How can that is so ungod-like? But no, it is God. Because, you know, the beautiful thing is in the Bhagavata Vahini, Swami describes all these ungod-like things of Krishna. And then he says, you feel that Krishna, when you read all this, you feel Krishna was a menace. But you know, take Krishna away and the whole Gokula would be weeping and moaning and crying. They would miss Krishna so desperately. They want Krishna. And that, Swami would say, that is divinity. I will do everything that you don't like. But still when I leave you, you will miss me and cry for me. Why? Because that, I think that is one statement we have to highlight. Swami says, everything is done with pure love and selflessness. One, and I feel that is why Krishna is called the Purna Avatar, because it becomes very clear that somebody doesn't become God by what he does. But God is God because of selflessness and love. You kill people, you break pots, you do this, you do mischief, you tell lies, you do whatever. As long as the basis for that is pure love and selflessness, it is divine. So therefore it is difficult to say that this act is godly, this act is divine, this act is not divine. Any act that is saturated with love and selflessness becomes divine. You know, it is not as if, like they would say, it is not as if whatever Swami speaks is whatever, it is not as if whether Swami speaks the truth and whether Swami does righteousness. Whatever Swami speaks is the truth, whatever Swami does is righteousness. In the same way, it is with Krishna. Whatever Krishna does is divine because it is backed by purity and selflessness. And I think that is the reason why they say Krishna is a Purna Avatar. Because he has done things which are apparently not divine, which is so ungod-like, and yet that is a facet of God because, as we said, it is purity and selflessness. I'm reminded of this episode that Dr. T. Ravi Kumar, currently the warden of Brindavan campus, often narrates. He says how Swami came walking into the hostel one day and he walked into the kitchen. And in the kitchen, they were making this kind of sweet, karanji, or one sweet like that, wherein you take a dough and you fill the dough with sweet, and you press the dough and seal the sides and you fry that dough. And you get a fried snack, a sweet, wherein outside there's a crust which is very tasty and crisp and inside there is a sweet. So you eat it, it's lovely. So Swami went and he saw this was being made. Swami took little part of the dough that was being, Swami himself rolled the dough into a circle and then he neatly folded it into a semicircle and sealed the edges. And then he gave that to the cook and said, fry it. And that sweet that is added inside, in the local language is called Purnam. He said, Swami, but we have not kept the Purnam inside. You have not done the filling. Swami said, you just fry it. And he fried it. And after he fried it, he took it out, allowed it to cool for a few moments. Then Swami took that sweet in his hand with both the hands, broke it into half, and it was filled inside with sweet. And Swami said, Yentra, what? Anything that this hand touches becomes Purnam. And it is so meaningful, that statement, because Purnam in Sanskrit means complete. Swami said, anything that this hand touches becomes complete. It is not as if whether something is complete or not. The hand defines the completeness. Once it is touched by the Lord, it is complete, however it might be. And the other meaning of Purnam, as I already said, in the local language, it is that sweet filling. So anything that the divine hand touches becomes fulfilled and complete. It also becomes sweet. That is how it is. Anything that Lord Krishna's life touched, even when it is mischief, even when it is apparent lawlessness, even that became Purnam, became complete, became sweet. That is the beautiful, profound and powerful message of the Krishna avatar.
And when you're talking about Bhagavatam, as you said, it is about the Lord, it is also about the devotee, and it's about bhakti also. And this holds good even for that. Because Swami says that the real love is actually beyond what is right and wrong. You know, this is good, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant. So Swami says when you love God, it should be in that level which is beyond what is good and wrong, right and wrong. So when you say that the Gopikas looked at him and they were troubled by him, but still they loved him, this is an opportunity to express that kind of love. It is not about, oh, this Lord is so very lovable in the sense of he's so respectworthy, so I love him. Or he's doing the right things for me, so I love him. Here is a Lord, whether he's going to give me pain or he's going to give me pleasure. Here's a Lord, whether he's going to pull my leg or he's going to stand by me and, you know, save my honor. This Lord is lovable, that's all. And just reminds me of what the beautiful lines which Professor Kasturi writes in Loving God. And, you know, we all know the life of Professor Kasturi. He had a lot of reverses in life. You know,
losses.
His own health problems, his children's, his two sons died before him. His wife was very sick. And he writes this very, very profound and beautiful words in Loving God. He says, you know, I love my Swami not because he's going to give me something. Not even because he's going to love me back. I love my Swami because he's the most lovable being I've come across. And you know, when you talk about Krishna doing all of these things, and Swami says, still, if Krishna does not walk down that same alley, one day the Gopikas would start missing him so badly. The mothers would be complaining about him and start missing him so badly. This is what it is. They did not love him because of what he did or what he did not do, but he was the most lovable and they could not live without him. And you know, that was the beautiful Krishna avatar Swami is talking about here.
When you look at this from an intellectual lens, you know, the Jnana Marga, the path of wisdom, or the path of knowledge, it teaches you to go beyond the mind and the body. Then only you realize your oneness with the Atman or the soul and all that. The same is what happens in bhakti as well. Because in bhakti, as you yourself said, logic or reasoning, right, wrong, all this lie in the realms of the mind. And when you're ready to go beyond in your love, so whether it is jnana or bhakti, it is achieving the same thing. In bhakti also you are going beyond the mind because you are loving irrespective of right, wrong, good, bad, happy, sad, everything. So bhakti also helps. In fact, bhakti is possibly sweeter. That is the reason recently I was speaking to Ram Mohan sir, our English teacher from school. He is well past his 70 now. And he was telling how Swami told that the best path to follow is that of bhakti, because it will help you achieve the ultimate and it is also very enjoyable as you go through. Even like when you were saying, even the mischief and antics of Krishna become enjoyable. So while you are growing spiritually, you are also enjoying. It's like a win-win deal. So this is what Swami had told him. And one very interesting thing that happened is, I will not go into the story of Ram Mohan sir because it's so beautiful, but at one point in time he felt that he's doing everything in his everything in the day as per bhakti, but he felt, I need to do more. I want to do more. I want to grow spiritually. So he decided that he wants to get into possibly jnana, and one of the things that is closely associated with jnana is dhyana. So he wanted to do meditation. So he went to Swami and said, Swami, I want to meditate, Swami. Swami said, very nice. He said, Swami, what should I meditate on? And he said, Swami told him, Ramyate iti Ramaha, meaning that which enchants is Rama. And Swami said, the other meaning of this statement is, Rama is supposed to be God, that which enchants is Rama. So Swami said, what? The form that enchants you, that is your Rama. Whichever form of God enchants you, meditate on that form. And so Ram Mohan sir said that for me, Swami is the form that would enchant, so I decided to meditate on Swami. And he saw that in this meditation, there are three stages, concentration, contemplation, and then meditation. So he decided to begin with stage one, which is concentration. And he said, what he would do is, he would sit in the bhajan hall. If you have seen in the end, there are two steps that lead up to that Krishna Arjuna chariot statue.
Right.
So there are two steps. So he said, I would sit on the second step so I get a vantage height and I would look at Swami and I would keep concentrating on him, because concentration is the first step towards meditation. And Swami said, meditate on the form that enchants you, and Swami is the form that enchants me, so therefore I'll begin by focusing. And he said that in the initial few days he would do that. He would sit and keep staring at Swami. One day he said, at a distance he saw, Swami seemed to like look away from his stare and like brush away his stare. But then he thought, this is possibly my imagination and it is something else that Swami is doing. But 2-3 times it looked like Swami is turning away from him and brushing his stare away, you know. And then he said, the next day Swami walked up to him and said, hey, Bhagwantudini Premato Chudali. Swami told him, when you look at God, you have to look at him with love. Otherwise, it's of no use. he said, Ramon sir said that, you know, I had forgotten in my enthusiasm and I would keep staring at him with laser pointed focus. Swami said, no, you, when you focus also you have to focus with love. That is when he realized that even in the path of meditation, this love or bhakti is so important. Without that bhakti rasa, it is like, that's why it's called bhakti rasa. It is like that gulab jamun and rasgulla, those are traditional Indian sweets that are dipped in sugar syrup. Without this bhakti rasa, without the liquid of bhakti, they will be like that gulab jamun or rasgulla which are not dipped in that. They won't be sweets at all. They will not be called as sweet itself. That is why even in the path of jnana or karma, whatever, bhakti is very essential, that sweetness, and that is the sweetness that gets inspired by the Krishnavatar.
And when we talk about Krishnavatar and that bhakti, it becomes so much more easier because Swami says everything about him was so sweet. Everything about him was so, you know, delectable. That's what Swami would say, that his looks, whatever he spoke, his smile, because Swami would describe that scene of all the Gopikas would come and complain to Mother Yashoda about all his antics and mischief. But at the end of it, they'll tell, but don't shout at him, don't be too harsh with him, because we can't see him cry. You know, that was the Lord who, you know, you don't know what to do with him. And, you know, we all know what it is, what that feeling is, because we have seen one avatar and we know that that's what it is. You, even when you complain, who else will you go and complain to? Even if you want to cry, whose feet will you go and lie down and cry? And, you know, that's Krishna, and I hope we'll continue with this story next week too, because Swami very beautifully, I mean, it's a very short chapter where Swami describes, but as you were saying, in few phrases, Swami describes, and each one of those phrases worth dwelling into, and I think that's what we'll do next week.
And now, dear listeners, we'll conclude with a song that speaks about exactly this aspect of Krishna, that everything about Krishna is sweet. That is why, whether he is doing something apparently nice to you or he's doing a mischief to you, you miss him because you miss the sweetness. And this is the popular and famous Madhurashtakam, which describes how everything about the Lord is sweet. We'll end on this note with gratitude to Bhagwan for this wonderful opportunity. We hope you enjoyed yourself as we have enjoyed ourselves. As always, you can write to us with any of your feedback, your comments, your thoughts, your love, anything, to listener@radiosai.org. We will now conclude with the Madhurashtakam, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love.
Adharam madhuram vadanam madhuram nayanam madhuram hasitam madhuram hridayam मधुराधिपते अखिलं मधुरम् अधरं मधुरं वदनं मधुरं नयनं मधुरं हसितं मधुरम् अधरं मधुरं वदनं मधुरं नयनं मधुरं हसितं मधुरं हृदयं मधुरं गमनं मधुरं मधुराधिपतेरखिलं मधुरं वचनं मधुरं चरितं मधुरं वसनं मधुरं पलितं मधुरं वचनं मधुरं चरितं मधुरं वसनं मधुरं पलितं मधुरं चलितं मधुरं भ्रमितं मधुरं मधुराधिपतेरखिलं मधुरं वेणुर्मधुरो रेणुर्मधुरः पाणिर्मधुरः पारं मधुरं वेणुर्मधुरो रेणुर्मधुरः पाणिर्मधुरः पारं मधुरं मधुराधिपते रखिलौ मधुरम गीतम मधुरम पीतम मधुरम भुक्तम मधुरम सुप्तम मधुरम गीतम मधुरम पीतम मधुरम भुक्तम मधुरम सुप्तम मधुरम रूपम मधुरम मधुराधिपते रखिलौ मधुरम करणम मधुरम तरणम मधुरम हरणम मधुरम स्मरणम मधुरम करणम मधुरम तरणम मधुरम हरणम मधुरम स्मरणम मधुरम ममितम मधुरम शमितम मधुरम मधुराधिपते रखिलम मधुरम कुंजा मधुरा माला मधुरा यमुना मधुरा वीची मधुरा कुंजा मधुरा माला मधुरा यमुना मधुरा वीची मधुरा सलिलम मधुरम कमलम मधुरम मधुराधिपते रखिलम मधुरम गोपी मधुरा लीला मधुरा युक्तम मधुरम मुक्तम मधुरम गोपी मधुरा लीला मधुरा युक्तम मधुरम मुक्तम मधुरम गावो मधुरा यष्टिर्मधुरा सृष्टिर्मधुरा गोपा मधुरा गावो मधुरा यष्टिर्मधुरा सृष्टिर्मधुरा दलितं मधुरं फलितं मधुरं मधुराधिपते रखिलौ मधुरं मधुराधिपते रखिलौ मधुरम मधुराधिपते